see and hear. If everybody can raise their hand if they can see and hear me. Very good. All right. And we know that nobody's calling in right now. So we're good to go, Lisa.
Okay, so I will just say the meeting's being recorded.
Please say permission to record when I do the roll.
Yes, yes, please say that. Go ahead, Lisa.
All right, you have to do that. I call the December 1st.
I'm sorry, I'm stumbling on the first part, I'm sorry. I call the December 1st, 2020 committee of the whole meeting of the Glencoe Park District to order. Lisa, please call the roll and note the time.
It is 7:07. Commissioner Boren.
Yes, permission to report.
Commissioner Covey.
Yes, permission to report.
Mr. Ludden.
Yes, permission to report.
Commissioner Underdonk. Okay, we'll come back to him. Chair Brooks.
Yes, for permission to record.
All right.
Okay.
So that Dudley's here, we're just having dial-in problems. He can hear and see us.
Okay.
For the record.
All right. It is our practice not to address questions at this time. However, we will take comments under advisement. Is there anyone who would like to make a verbal comment? If so, please limit comments to 3 minutes per person. Is anyone on that would like to make a comment? Okay, I will take that as a no. Let's move to our first item on the agenda, discussion on Cock Park Phase 2 renovation concept. Lisa Shepherd and Chris Liner will lead the discussion.
Great. Well, actually, I'm going to throw it right over. I think you said John was going to give the presentation today. John from Ultima News is going to give the presentation for the Cock Park Phase 2 renovation concept. We sent a smaller version of the presentation to you last week. So I'm going to throw it over to John and pull something up. Green, I believe.
Okay. There's more information, and there's a lot of information about our process. That's how we got there. So, also, some people know a lot about stormwater. Some people don't, so please have patience if I am a little pedantic. Okay, I'm going to share my screen. Let's see, of course it's covering everything, slideshow, here we go. Okay, ready?
Yes.
Can everyone hear and can everyone see? Can you all see that?
Okay. Yes.
Off we go. You've seen this, we're going to look at existing condition, potential solutions, electrical and additional issues. Background. The storm water is divided in Glencoe between flowing towards Skokie River and the lagoons are towards Lake Michigan. If you get closer in on that along Park Avenue, it starts, the storm sewer starts to slowly descend towards the lake. So at Kelp Park, it's really quite high. And that will end up being important because it creates issues with connecting to the sewer because Kelp Park is below the street. Here's existing conditions. Excuse me. You can see it's 2.6 acres. The meadow is remarkably flat. When I got the survey, I thought they'd made a mistake because I couldn't see any contours, but in fact, there weren't any. It's literally almost flat.
Hi, Kevin.
Like most parks in Glencoe,
it's
an open space that wasn't developed because it's actually low. The soils are a thin layer of topsoil over clay, and there's minimal water percolation, which is also important.
Yeah, 82.
A quote from Mr. Liner. The meadow at Kelp Park over the last few years has been flooded from February, when the clay is still frozen, through June, to July, and during hot weather, the water heats and the heated water kills irrigated plants. The storm sewer, which you can see is that blue line, slopes towards the lake and is not deep on Park Avenue at Calk Park. The meadow at Calk is almost completely flat, therefore, there would be little sheet flow across the surface of stormwater without significant regrading. An underdrain system would be necessary. That underdrain system comes from CVAL, our engineers. This is their first theme. Park Avenue is at the top. You can see there's a series of underdrains that go parallel with Park Avenue. And then they're collected and they go to a manhole at the main sewer. The pipes flow east parallel to the storm sewer.
Hello?
Hi, Dudley. We're in the middle of the presentation John is giving.
Okay, yeah, I heard part of it.
Great.
Can you hear me, Dudley?
I can hear it. There's some feedback.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
I'll continue, John. Thank you.
All right.
Okay, I can hear you.
Okay, Dudley, until you want to speak, since I'm getting feedback from you, could you mute? Is that possible?
Oh, yeah. How's this?
All right, I'll continue.
Is that better?
Yes.
The host muted you. Okay.
So
okay.
The upper drains flow towards the sewer. Because we've got to get to a point where we can feed into the main sewer system from Park Avenue. So Calk is lower than the road. The pipes flow towards the manhole at the northeast. I won't read all of this, but the proposed system from CVAL is made out of recycled materials. The pipes are set in 2 feet of topsoil and stone, and then wrapped in a non-woven geotextile as a filter. It's also chemical free. To get a quote from Mike Kerr, the president of CVAL, the meadow could be considered as a biofiltration basin. But I will show you an example of that later.
So the wrapping material around the pipe is considered a biodynamic material?
Correct. It's a filter.
Okay.
And the stone works in a similar way. You can see the entire project, if we use this scheme and also do lighting, some fences, and some planting, you can see the cost. 311.
Yes.
Now,
yes.
We know Dudley knows a lot about green solutions, and just to give you some background, we've worked on a lot of all different scales, from major ones, huge wetlands, down to street infiltration planters and constructed wetlands and bias wells. The example on the right is Taylor Park, no park, but Dudley knows. For those who don't know, what is a bias well? It's basically a ditch that water, stormwater, flows into. It goes through soil and plant material and slowly filters into the soil. The meadow at Calk is almost completely flat. There will be little sheet flow of stormwater to a bias well. An underdrain system will be necessary. And when the water gets to a proposed bias well, we get this. So there's 12 to 16 inches of topsoil, and then there's that amazing, impenetrable clay soils that are all over Glencoe, and that's one of the reasons there's so much standing water in your parks. Nothing, almost nothing percolates through that clay. I know Dudley knows all about this. Philadelphia is considered probably in the forefront of green stormwater infrastructure. What that means is a sustainable version of drainage. The example shown here is what's called a bioinfiltration basin. It's basically you cut down into the soil, water goes in and it drains through the soil. As it does so, pollutants are removed. Now, it would be great if we could use a smaller version, and it would seem ideal in health. However, because the soils are clay under a tiny surface of topsoil, it would flood. It just wouldn't go anywhere. And because it's low, and calc is low, you'd start taking in water from the surrounding area. The solution given by initial solution, this is an evolving process, from Siebel is this, which you probably won't be able to read, so I transferred it into this. So the bioswale, this basic ditch full of plants and amended soil, would allow water to percolate down to the bottom where there'd be a pipe. And that pipe would bring water, that storm water, out to an overflow, through an overflow to the storm sewer on the park. This is again from Mike, who unfortunately can't be with us. He's somewhere in southern Indiana.
Okay.
Bioswales are typically used for surface runoff, which we don't have unless we regrade basically most of this park. To use a bioswale with pipe under drains, we are vertically challenged. Now, he lists all the various elevations, but let me translate that. What that is, and this is an exaggerated diagram so we can understand it, this is the bioswale, and in the background, that blue line is the storm sewer, which it would be slightly higher than that pipe. So you can see there's an issue. How can you get to the storm? A typical detail for a bioswale is this. It shows water going into the bioswale. It infiltrates down through that soil to another pipe and then heads out towards the main sewer. Or if it flows, overflows, it goes down the vertical pipe and goes out to the storm.
Mm-hmm. John, that's what we have at Tinkiff, correct?
Correct. Here, the issue is the overflow directly to the storm sewer on Park Avenue is high.
It's an elevation problem. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. Thank you. And if I don't explain it well, please do so for me. When it starts filling, only the surface water will go to the storm sewer. So it doesn't work very well, but why is this an issue? This is research from North Carolina University and Ohio State. Quote, standard roadside vegetated swales, that's a bioswale with plants in it, often do not provide consistent pollutant removal. To increase infiltration and pollutant removal, bioswales are designed with an underlying soil media and an underdrain. So that's what we just saw. When they carried out the research, they found only the underdrain effluent concentrations were below North Carolina's high quality water limit, perhaps due to a first flush bacteria which was treated by the soil media. So the lower pipe actually, which has nothing got to do initially with the bio swale, contains or gives off cleaner water. So what's the issue? When we were working on Lakeshore Drive, the big issue through. Because that's the initial water that's full of all the pollutants. So
right.
We created sort of chambers that would take away the first flush and then let, like, later flow go over the land. However, if we let first flush go directly to the storm sewer, which would happen in this particular scenario, we would actually be sending the dirtiest water to the storm sewer. The constructed wetland at Taylor that we worked on overflows into a combined sewer during and after major events. It's just not deep enough. However, it does provide habitat for insects and birds and creates interest for visitors. It's quite beautiful. So we continue to examine a green solution. And this was the one in the first presentation that was sent out.
Mm-hmm.
Avenue at the top, Old Green Bay on the left, gazebo in the center, and then the idea was to dig out a portion of this that would receive stormwater from across the park. And we had planting that would thrive in that sort of situation. However, the meadow of kelp, as we know, is already flat. Therefore, there will be little sheet flow of stormwater to the rainbow. This is from the engineers. An under-drained system would still be necessary. An overflow to the storm sewer would not guarantee cleaner water. So, that's the first one. Add an overflow structure from the rain garden. The second is to excavate to a level that contains detain the stormwater that will cost a fortune because you have so much stormwater. Expand the size of the rain garden. There are two issues there. If we disturb too much of the park, the Metropolitan Water Reclamation District new requirements will kick in, and we'd have to convert a large area of that meadow into a space. The other issue is the park is an active park. So what do you want? Do you want a wetland or a useful park downtown? And they're sort of the extremes. So the first scheme, the under-drain scheme, is 311,000. The rain garden, and we could do all sorts of varieties of that, is more expensive. Now, that's creating it. But then there's the cost of maintenance. The under drains are the easiest, or at least the cheapest, to maintain. And as you go up, it gets more expensive. And this is very important to Park District staff.
Mm-hmm.
The budget filtration basin where you just mow grass, if it works, is great. The rain garden becomes more complex, because we've also stripped plants. The bios, and that's relatively small, a bioswale, which we need at least, and kelp gets bigger, plus it's got complex planting. For instance, and then constructive wetlands, the most expensive. The constructive wetland at Taylor Park costs about $3,000 for the first 3 years to establish plants. That was maintained by a specialist firm, and after that, the park district has to maintain it. So, the evaluation between Rebel ourselves staff, the under-drain system will deal with stormwater issues. My Kerr says, I would suggest that our underdrains provide water quality benefit as they are placed in 2 feet of topsoil surrounded by stone, much like a bioswale. And as Dudley pointed out, it would also have a geotextile filter. Quote from Mike, the meadow with underdrains could be considered as a biofiltration basin. The Green Solutions investigate do not significantly improve the removal of pollutants in this case due to the various constraints at CalPark. The underdrain system is the least expensive to maintain due to the conditions at CalPark. The Green Solution could provide visual appeal and habitat. However, Park District staff stated that CalPark is a downtown park that is expected to be intensively used, not as a habitat exhibit. Other suitable locations have been since just about every park floods in Glencoe, there may be more suitable. We could also add a storm scepter to the underdrain system, or other water quality device between the underdrain system and the catch basin. This would improve the quality of water leaving the site, but would need to be maintained. This is basically what that is. The water comes in from the left, is pushed down, and is filtered, goes across and up and exits. The slope chamber allows a lot of sediment to drop down into a tray, and then the water continues. So if you do something like this, you could have the under drains with filtered water coming from 2 feet of soil and stone and a filter fabric, then going through this and out to the storm sewer.
Hey, John?
Yeah.
You mentioned time and time again about the concern of pollutants in the water and whether bioswales can take care of them or whether we have a storm scepter mask. Can you explain to a layman such as myself what pollutants are in this park that are not sort of everywhere in Glencoe? Like, what makes us more concerned about the pollutants in the water in this park versus the house next door to the park, or versus other parks? Like, is there something special about this one?
No, the real pollutants in Glencoe, like everywhere else, are the roadways.
So
they are the ones that, you know, have the exhaust with all sorts of nasty heavy metals, lots of oil and grease, but they go into the storm sewers along the streets. The water in Cal, in fact, is probably cleaner.
The only thing that jumps out to me, Michael, is likely fertilizers and herbicides. That would be general use stuff that you would see in most people putting down for dandelions or make the grass grow, that kind of thing.
Yeah, of course it is next to the railroad tracks too, and the road intersection. So there's some pollutants there. But I'm coming to understand where you're coming from, and it makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, and even that, we're a little distant from the train, and there's not much like rushing by of cars in the car park, and that has a separate, it goes to a separate track. Then Mike had one other suggestion. He actually thinks this will not work unless you had some form of underdrain system. However, there is a low spot on the west of the park that does fill with water. So we could either link that in, we could create a rain garden there. It's more like a demonstration rain garden, to be honest. And that could link into this particular pipe system, or we could daylight it into the parking lot. And the water would actually be cleaner than the surface water parking lot.
However, is that what's shown on the diagram here?
Yeah.
That particular thing. Now, that's going to be an additional cost, though, is that right?
Yeah, it would be.
Yeah.
For creation and for maintenance.
What was that, 300 plus million? Or not a million, thousand.
No. It would be minor cost.
Okay.
Compared to really taking
I really like the idea of the demonstration rain garden for a whole lot of reasons, not only the educational reasons, but it does help to clean the water. I'm pretty well convinced that that's a great solution. I wasn't aware how the, I'll call them bioinfiltration filters, are wrapped around the drainage tile, and that seems to catch or deter the pollutants from the, I'll call it the play field.
Also, having the...
How does this then relate to the other issue, which is the discharge of the water from the site itself?
How does what relate? The rain garden?
Well, okay, what's happening here is that you've established a drain tile system, what I'll call a drain tile system, and then that drains into the village stormwater system.
Correct.
By establishing the drain system, you're adding to the peak load in the village stormwater system. Is that right?
Correct.
Okay.
Which was a concern of ours.
Yeah. But before I go there, we've been through this with the Hoover Estate, and their solution was a combination of cisterns and actually I won't call them rain gardens, but flooded ponds. In my experience, one way to deal with that is simply to oversize that major pipe, and that'll give you a lot of storage, and then with a smaller orifice, you can control some of that volume of water. The reason why I'm so interested in that is I want to knock down the peak of that water going into the village stormwater system, because that drains over near the beach, and we have some erosion issues over there and through the ravine. So I just wanted to see if that would make it any kind of improvement.
We certainly could use that system, and that's the detail I'd like to give to Mike, but we have used large underground pipes for that very issue in projects in Chicago, and you're correct, we could, with the interceptor, slow the flow of stormwater into the main floor.
John,
Josie knows a lot about this. Too.
Once the board can firm up a concept, that's all things that we're obviously going to work out at the staff level with the village engineer and Dave Mile, the director of public works. So we typically do a design review with them at the staff level, and they make those comments and give us those directions, and then we kind of go from there once the board has, you know, settled on a design.
Josie,
okay.
I'm sorry you can't hear me or see me, but what I want to say is I like your presentation. I appreciate the thought that went into this. I've learned a little bit. I've liked the board to consider what I'll call the demonstration rain garden option, if it's not too expensive, as we go into this. That seems like a great solution, and you may be able to work that into the regulating the volume of discharge from the property as well.
I would just like to know that the rain garden is not in our current budget. So we were just trying to fix the problem of the flooding in front of Hawk. So that's not in our budget, nor is any extra funds to maintain that. I know last month we talked about staff time to take care of conservation areas such as this. The board indicated to staff that they wanted to keep what we have now but not add to it. So that would be adding to that problem. So just keep that in mind. Whatever.
It's a policy decision for the board. John, you led me to believe the actual construction would not be terribly high on your proposed rain garden. Is that right?
The one that's shown here?
Yes.
The
depending on the size, of course, and if there's, presumably we'd have an overflow drain. I mean, small ones we've done that are probably about 25 feet long and about 10 feet wide, for the size of anywhere between $18,000 and
$30,000.
So,
from a maintenance perspective, we would typically be bundling this likely into our existing conservation contract if the board decided to move forward. I would bet we'd probably be in the $5,000 to $8,000 range per year for a specific visit to this site for that type of an amenity. So, just, you know, could come in a little less, could come in a little more, but we're paying about $8,000 to $9,000 a year for the swale maintenance at Takeoff right now, which is five visits out from the stewards.
Quick question. The rain gardens that we have at Takeoff, are they all native plants, or are they native and locally adapted plants?
I'd have to look at the list, but I'm pretty sure they're all natives.
From my perspective, I would be more than happy to mix the two if that results in a saving. Or even just make it grass.
You mean just the depression in the ground?
Yes.
I guess my only reservation with that, and I'll just say this very quickly because I know there's more with Koch that we should talk about before we kind of open the floor to discussion, but the only thing I might address, Dudley, would be that this is such a highly visible spot that it sort of asks for beauty, you know, because it's kind of at this intersection with the start of the Glencoe Connect and the
new, oh, I hear you. And if this is the what we call the central celebration part of the community.
Yes, yes.
It's so probably best to dress it up. That's what you're saying.
In my
mind, this is more important than Takeoff from that perspective.
Well,
I think we've already removed one rain garden at Takeoff.
I would say we're not going to, if this is something that's going to hold water, I would think athletic turf grass is not going to be the option that we want to choose. I think it's going to be a mud hole, and we're going to end up exactly in the same position we are with the turf that we have in the center of the park, which is open mud.
Right. And Takeoff, remember, Dudley, Takeoff is an experiential area for all the young children who are at the building that when they take walks, and so it really is, you know, a scientifically engaging area. So not to say this isn't a good idea, I just would caution that doing it the cheap way, this might not be the location for doing it.
I hear you. Yeah, if we're going to do it, if we're going to do it, we should do it right. Okay.
Yeah. Okay, so...
Okay, well, we'll just, you know, we have a ballpark figure as to what it would take to build it and maintain it, and we'll have to look at that as we talk about our budget and setting aside money for this project.
Okay, so we have this budget of $311. If I can just confirm, should we choose to go with this additional scheme with the single rain garden, it would be in the range of $11,000 to $18,000. Wait,
eighteen to thirty
with the additional maybe $10,000 a year, $8,000 whatever a year for maintenance, depending on what we do. Just to keep that, you know, kind of in the back of our mind.
In our minds. Uh-huh.
Yeah, before we started a discussion. Would you like Altamanu, would you like to continue with the open it up to discussion about this section of the presentation, or would you like to just finish the Koch presentation?
I'd like to just get it finished, and then we can talk.
Yeah, that's great.
Okay.
All right, I'll continue. Thank you. We didn't go into underground storage tanks because of the amount of soil that would have to be moved, and it just gets a little too complex.
Yeah, I'm good with that.
We spent quite a bit of time looking at light. Glencoe, like most of the North Shore communities, has a very traditional touchy-feely lighting palette vocabulary. And we kept that in mind. At the same time, we wanted something that looked and acted in a contemporary way. This is a light designed, it's a light pole, etc., designed by Stern, a very famous architect from New York. We think it's got a very traditional and contemporary look, and it's got contemporary LED technology. It's been installed in Savannah, you can see here, and in parts of New York. So, some information on the Ashbury. It's LED technology and optics, glare control, which is important. You know, you're not going to be stunned by the light. Because of LED and glare controls, you have lower light levels and lower energy use. It's very practical for staff. It's tenant mounted luminaires, and they can be retrofitted in the field. It's dark sky compliant, which I'm sure, Dudley, that would be important to you.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, so it's a very controlled, and we can control and modulate the actual cast from the light. Mostly the light will be in the wooded areas, and because there's going to be some ambient light coming in from Park Avenue, from the park, and there's less vegetation and trees there, so you're going to get more ambient light. So the sustainable solutions, if we go where I think we're going, is native plants will be added to the park and planting beds. We'll have recycled materials in the drainage system. We'll have dark sky compliant light fixtures. We'll have LED lights and optics, which will actually save our energy. The next thing is the basketball court. The planting along the edge between the basketball court and the parking lot does not stop the balls, and they bounce out and either go down into the parking lot or all the way down into the pavement. So there has been a request to do something about that, and the idea is to add a 6-foot-high black chain link fence. The other one is this. It's a real conflict zone. You cannot see the bikes coming. You're just waiting for an accident. People going from the parking lot into the park. So we'd like to remove, we're all for trees and planting, but in this case, the U may have to go, and you would be replanting the planting beds in front of you with mostly native plants. And then long term, it would be nice to have a symmetric entrance into Park Avenue, with a similar plaza on the south side of the park as is being built right now on the west side. That's it. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Very well.
Is Josephine going to add anything specific to this, John, or was this, now you're opening up to questions for both of you?
Just opening up to questions.
Okay, great. All right. So, commissioners?
Chris, can I just have you confirm what the initial budget amount was?
So, Carol, the initial budget that we showed in the bond issuance paperwork, we estimated the project at $300,000. So the working budget of $311,000 at this point does include a 20% contingency, which is $60,000.
Okay.
And it does include professional service fees. I think that we can massage it and definitely make sure that we come in around that $300,000 mark. I think that there's some flexibility in some of the things that I've seen in the project and the big climate that we have right now. I would say that our base bid is right on target. I think John and Josephine would probably agree with me on that right now.
Okay. So Lisa, the primary question is A, door one or door two, A or B, and then attached to that, whether there would be any additional
consideration for putting in a rain garden. We all know what the additional expense is estimated for that. So does any commissioner have a pretty strong feeling as to which of these two choices is best? Go ahead, Josh.
I want to first say to John and Josephine how much I enjoyed the presentation and the work. I read it over the weekend, and it was very informative, so thank you both for the sending it along ahead of time and for the presentation tonight, John. I was, as my fellow commissioners know, I generally, you know, err on the side of environmental or sustainable solutions. In this particular instance, I found myself thinking option one is clearly preferable, given the desire to, first of all, this is a relatively small park. It's turf grass, for the most part, it's turf grass already. And the historical and intended use of this is sort of high intensity, you know, not contemplative nature use, but, you know, public access for events. And so I thought the proposed solution was very good and anticipates how we intend to use the park. I felt that I guess when it comes to the rain garden option, my preference would be to pass on it if we were going to invest that kind of money. That sort of seemed like environmental theater to me, and I would rather use those funds for truly more natural areas of our park system, whether that be parts of Glencoe Connect for some future project that we might do, or something at Shelton Park, or something at one of the parks that's not connected to Green Bay Road, but is a more natural area to begin with. The particular lighting fixtures that you guys chose, I thought were attractive. My own particular vision would be either something that's more at sort of knee level, and just physically smaller, that simply provides for enough light to see the path. Frankly, my own personal preference would be, you know, get a flashlight and let's save some money. But if we're going to have lights, I guess I would prefer to see something that's more ankle or knee level. But if my other commissioners don't agree with me, I thought that the lights that you chose were attractive given the genre that they fell in. Really liked the thoughts about the entrance. I remember thinking that when I first read the presentation, both in terms of a potential symmetrical approach in the future, but more importantly, the sight lines there are just horrible. And I'm on that trail, you know, four times a week. And I just can absolutely attest to the sense of anxiety that one feels moving through there, whether on foot or on a bicycle. I think addressing that would be a lot of value added. I think that's all I have to say. Thanks for the opportunity. Good presentation, guys.
Thank you, Josh. Michael, do you have some thoughts on which of these two choices you prefer?
You know, this is one of the nice things about having a well-rounded board is you have people on it who are passionate and care about a whole host of things. So I loved hearing what Josh said. I really liked hearing Dudley's comments. This is not something that, you know, I'm an expert in or that I have a great passion for. So I think going with the option that, you know, Lisa, this is one of the things we're going to defer to you guys on. You guys seem to really like option one. There's nothing in option one I didn't like. I want the park to be used. You know how I feel about underutilized assets. but in terms of lighting or underground, you know, sewer filtration systems, I think, hey, look, there's something. You know, I'm going to defer to, you know, other board members who are much more knowledgeable about this, and to you guys, Lisa. I think the presentation was great. I learned a lot from it. Who knew that we in Glencoe may have lights that only exist in New York and possibly some places in Florida?
Georgia.
Oh, jeez. I see the lights are beautiful in person.
I'm sure there are. I mean, they look great. Look at you guys. You guys do good work. You do a great job. I think Josh said it best. I yield my time to the other senators.
Dudley, do you have a summation? You've had a chance to make some comments.
First of all, I want to compliment our consultants for such an in-depth analysis. One of the things that I really appreciate is informed decision-making, and that really helps me, and I think will help the board make an informed decision. These kinds of decisions are, of course, based on both information and values, and I really appreciate having the information side of things put in front of me. With respect to the lighting, as long as we can control the light trespass to the neighbors, I know that's always a concern in the park and recreation world. I like the setup for the lights. They're very appropriate. I'm sure they'll be timed and all that stuff as well, and bird friendly and that stuff. The fence, it makes a lot of sense along there. And I guess the only thing I could add with respect to the drainage is that perhaps if the bids come in really, really well, we might want to reconsider a small rain garden, but we'll see how that goes.
Thank you, Dudley, and thanks for all of your good thoughts and questions. I think it pushed us to pay closer attention, so I appreciate that. I'll just very quickly say, in all the comments, salient comments, great. Michael, you asked a question kind of midstream, and I thought it was really valuable. You said, why do we really care about this? And I think that's a reasonable thing to ask. But the way I look at it is that homeowners don't really necessarily think, because they're not required to, about sustainability issues the way the district is required to think about it. We made that as one of our key, you know, principles. And when we're doing a new project, we have to overlay these issues over our projects. And I think that was done really well here. And again, thank you for explaining things to us. I thought it was incredibly interesting. As for the lighting, I love it. I think lighting and design is such an integral part of the way something looks, both inside and outside. So I think really good lighting is going to make an impact beyond just safety, which I know has been called out as an issue in this park. And I just think it's visually going to be great. The one thing I thought when I read through the presentation is we're going to want to make some symmetry with, I know this is coming with the veterans across the street. I think it's going to call out for creating something at the entrance that reflects what's directly across the street. So I feel that coming like a train, but, you know, that's for another time. Absolutely yes with option number one. And, you know, let's reconsider the rain garden at another time if that's something the other commissioners would like. And that leaves Stephanie.
I really only have one question. So the entrance, if we wanted to do the thin entrance in Veterans Park, which I know is not in the budget right now, is there anything that has to be done now to be able to do that later? Does that make sense?
Yes. I mean, Stephanie, John, and correct me if I'm wrong, I do believe we have some maintenance to the existing masonry wall that's in the budget, correct?
Correct, yes. Repointing and replacement of any deteriorated stone.
So I think if we're on that thought process, this whole project here at Calk is because we chose not to do this the last time 5 years ago.
Yeah.
So I think, you know, there is some merit to having a discussion about this plaza gateway entrance here, because we may find ourselves in an unprecedented bid climate because of COVID-19. And if it's something that the board is really thoughtful and that they want to pursue, I think it's worth a dialogue instead of trying to say, let's come back in 3 years and do it if it's something that we really want to do. I mean, because Josephine, offhand, do you recall what that plaza at Veterans ran us about with the brick pavers, the underlayment, the irrigation? That put her on the spot.
So, and I'm going to say...
So the board can make an informed choice?
Can we say about 65?
Yeah, I think that's fair.
I mean, Chris, I know I'm probably going to regret starting this conversation, but I like what you're saying because, look, I wasn't around when Cough Park 1 came. We're doing Cough Park 2, and already people are talking about Cough Park 3, which is this entranceway.
Yes.
We have saved, I think, a bunch of money on other projects with Glenbrook Connect due to COVID, just people coming in less. Is it on the table to even talk? I mean, personally, I'm sort of indifferent, but it sounds like, you know, Lisa Brooks and Stephanie, who are bringing up great points, and Josh, talk about this symmetry, and that it'll be nice to have it. I kind of like it, but it's not necessarily, again, something to, you know, fall on the sword for, in my opinion. But is there value in doing this now? I'd rather pay $60,000 now than $80,000 later.
And Michael, I can see Carol smiling, because what I would say is that you run the risk of a year three project not happening. I mean, you know, we have a list of projects, and obviously, you know, that could mean that a year three project doesn't get to happen until year four or five.
Right.
I mean, that's theoretically possible. I mean, we could find that we have a really tight bid climate and we can get this in at 330, 340, something like that. But, you know, I think we always run the risk of knowing that we're spending today's money, tomorrow's money today. So I think it's important not to talk about Cough Phase 3 when it took us 5 years to get to Cough to Phase 2.
And again, Chris, I'm summarizing what Lisa Brooks, Stephanie Boron, and Josh Lutton are saying, and I don't think Shelby mentioned it, and I certainly didn't mention it, but, you know, I guess I'd throw the question to Lisa Shepherd and Carol. Like, is it smart of us as a board to think about augmenting this budget with perhaps there's resources elsewhere I'm just not aware of, Carol, you would know, to get it done right the second time as opposed to the third time?
Mm-hmm. I would just be mindful, and I don't know if you have it handy, Chris, to put up all the projects over the 3 years that we decided there's projects out there that are not funded. And so I would be leery to add on to this project total without the board first looking at what those other projects are and also the possibility of maybe those other projects really aren't what the costs are that we've estimated them to be 2 and 3 years down the road. Just a word of caution.
I would ask before we would even contemplate anything else, Michael or Chris, is how does that fit in relationship with that larger area, not just strictly the Park District property, but building on my point about, you know, the sight lines being limited when you're biking or running down that sidewalk. Maybe it shouldn't be a sidewalk. Maybe it should be a trail, right? There's tons of people going through there
from north
to south. And I think there's been some conversation about a bridge and redoing that parking lot. And Lisa, it sounds like you're going to bring us up to date on that.
Well, yeah. There is some talk from the village of doing some trail work down there. And Chris would know more, but I don't know how that flows into that whole entranceway. And I don't know if the village has the money right now, but there is talk about looking at that possibility and going for a grant once they have money to change that into more of a trail. And they're not going to do a bridge, I know that for sure, but they're looking at ways to do the trail differently, where that goes a little bit onto our property, but that would definitely be a village project. And I don't know how that would affect that entryway. Does Chris know?
So one of the things that Dave Mao and I have talked about with the scope of this project is making sure that we're not going to put anything in that has to be torn out in 2 or 3 years if there is work done on that trail. So I know the village brought in tool and did some work down on that intersection that's such a trouble. They did a study on if a bridge is possible, why it wouldn't be possible, why it wouldn't be possible. I can say, you know, we haven't really sat down and put pen to paper and said, this is our idea for, you know, the Cock Park Plaza. I mean, I think there's merits to, you know, saying let's do that as part of a trail project, but there's also merits to saying if we're going to tear the park up once, tear it up once. So I
agree with that, Chris, but my inclination with respect to Michael would be to say let's fix the drainage. We know that's not going to get screwed up by any future, you know, entrance or trail redesign. And, you know, we can change the sight lines of the entrance by removing a yew tree or by trimming a bush, right, which is not major hardscape. But if we start redesigning stuff and putting bricks and concrete in, then we are really kind of committing ourselves to a lot of money and a certain design.
Good call.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I mean, we'd always circle back around to the village and say, you know, this is the conceptual design. How does this fill into the trail project you're thinking of? I don't know if they're ready for that yet. And I don't know if we want to hold up our project because of that.
No, and Lisa, we could leave it with you to, you know, have a discussion with Phil, just sort of like broach the subject and see if there's any more information they have now that could influence this. Otherwise, we move forward with the plan as it is.
Okay.
Yeah, I like that idea, Lisa Brooks. As I said, I probably was going to regret starting the conversation. But I do think it's worthy of talking about because, quite frankly, for those who weren't around with Cock Park 1, when we talk about Cock Park 3, which Lisa says is like a train coming at us, at least we can say we thought about it and we evaluated it. And I couldn't agree more. The main goal here is drainage and making sure basketballs don't go into the parking lot.
Yeah. Okay. Is there anything more for our guests on this topic, or can we move on?
Just to confirm, so for December we're going to advance the option one plan to the board for approval.
Yes.
Okay. Thank you.
Lisa, if I may, I just want to thank our consultants for a good in-depth presentation. I know I took you down the rabbit hole a little bit, as you call it. But I think we have a much better understanding of how the process works, and I appreciate the depth of their presentation.
Very good. Well said. Okay, so they're not done yet because our next discussion is with Altima New again, contract design services for the South Overlook. And Lisa and Chris, you can lead them into this discussion.
I'm going to throw it to Chris on this one.
As the board may recall, we discussed previously, prior to the bond issuance, the work that needed to be done on the overlooks, retaining walls, the boathouse staircase, the retaining walls in that area. So we had a very successful approach with the North Overlook, the Schumann Overlook. We experienced a really great bid due to COVID-19, and we had a really great contractor who did a fine job. So We had initially talked about potentially, you know, doing that as a fall project, doing that as South Overlook, but we see the benefit of getting that project out onto the street during a very, very aggressive bid climate. So we'd like to move forward and bring Altima New and Chris Burke Engineering under contract to advance that to bidding and see that project completed in the spring if we can. So we have John and Josephine here to answer any questions about their proposal and what they've put into it if there is any questions at the board level.
A quick question. This is very similar to the work that you did, the Park District did on the Schumann Overlook?
That's correct, Dudley. It's very similar, and as a result, and it's primarily an engineering project. And as a result, the CBEL bid is a lot lower than the initial cost of the Northern Over. We put the specs together, and we are also reducing our fee because that part is done. What amazingly takes up so much time is actually the meetings and then the construction observation and site reports. So there is a certain amount we can take up with a certain amount that is just part of the process. For instance, on the Northern Overlook, we met with the village a few times. We met, we had a coordination with the water plant, etc. And there'll be some version of that going into this one as well.
So the fee is a reduced amount compared to what we were charged for the North Overlook, mainly, as John indicated, due to the fact that the major water transmission lines in Glencoe do not run under this overlook. So we did capture some savings in the sense that there isn't that necessary engineering issue. So they gave us a pretty tight cost compared to the previous project. So we're very pleased seeing it at the staff level.
And also, let's face it, Chris, we haggled Chris Burke down.
Well, Montrose's not here to defend himself tonight, but we've hit it off with Chris Burke Engineering in particular. They're doing the trail for us, and they've done a fine job, and we're going to be using them, hopefully, as our primary civil and structural engineering consultants for the short term here.
Seems like a good idea, guys.
Excellent.
I have a quick question. I noticed a distinction between the memorandum and then the letter from Altman New. Just a quick point. Whether it is a plan for planting between the overlook and the new wall, or if it's actually addition of soil and planting. Will soil and plantings be, are they part of this contract, or is it just the plan for it?
They are part of it in the specs. There is a similar amount of topsoil that will be added behind the retaining wall, and we will be planting. So it will be very similar in that respect to the overlook to the wall.
Okay, thank you. Does anyone have any questions for John, Josephine?
So are we good to advance that for approval in December also?
Josh, yes?
Yes.
Michael?
Yep.
Stephanie?
Did we say that we thought this was one where we can get a better price maybe?
No.
Not on this one?
I don't think on any of these. They've done a great job negotiating with our end. Engineers to get a really good price.
I thought what Chris mentioned that he thought the
construction contract, yeah. So this is just the professional services to develop the bid and the legal specifications and the prints and things. Yeah. So I do anticipate that if we can get this out on the street in February, that we're going to capture some aggressive price due to COVID-19.
Okay, yeah, that's what I was referring to.
Yeah, the bid climate's really good. That's why I wanted to go early.
Okay. Dudley?
Question?
Yep.
Yes.
The bid itself would hit the street when, and when do we anticipate completion of the project?
Well, the first step would be signing the contract with the landscape architect. So that would be what we were asking the board for in December, and then it would begin working on the bid in January, Josephine, end of January. We'd likely be hitting the street around that time and bringing something back to the board in February or March. We haven't really backed it out yet. We do see it likely as an early spring project, that's correct?
Yep.
Correct, yes. Yep. And the sooner we can get going, the better. Chris Burke is ready to go.
The lead time is for the materials, for the actual piling. They take about 6 weeks to be made. So once we sign we go out to bid, the board would then approve the bid, and then we sign a contract with the contractor, and we would break ground 6 to 8 weeks from that date. So I would expect end of April,
beginning of March at the earliest.
Well, my concern, of course, was that it's going to dovetail into the opening of the beach.
So it took them about 2.5 weeks to get the actual pilings in its entirety on the north side, and that was a little bit more complicated because of the water transmission lines. So my thought would be if we back into the opening of the beach season, we would not start the project until the fall.
Okay.
Okay, so Lisa, I think you have what you need on this.
I do, thank you.
Okay, and we will move on then finally to discussion with Altamanu regarding the contract design services for the Boating Beach staircase and retaining wall.
Go ahead, Chris. I'm going to throw it to you.
So I'm going to just share my screen to identify the actual area that this project is targeted at. So can everyone see my screen here?
Yeah, now we can.
Yes. Okay.
So this is the staircase that is currently leading to the Pearlman Boating Beach facility. So as you all recall, prior to Lake Michigan becoming extremely angry in the last 3 years, we used to be able to walk around the front of the water plant to the boating beach. Unfortunately, that's just not a realistic option right now with the lake levels that they're at. So this set of staircases has become really our only means of entry or exit to this facility. So the stairs are located right here on the backside of the village's water plant. So you walk in, if you haven't ever been there. Josh, I don't know if you're quite familiar with this site in particular.
Oh, yeah.
So you walk through the parking lot of the water plant, you walk down these stairs here. So they're not in wonderful condition. Obviously, we did a temporary repair in the spring because of the section of the staircase that actually collapsed. You can see it's a very sizable area. In particular, this area down the bluff, we're dealing with lots of different challenges, changes in elevations. Lake Michigan actually does come up to this staircase as well at times, so there's that to contend with as well. From a legal standpoint, it's likely that we are going to have to heavily explore what a switchback ramp would look like in this area. As far as ADA accessibility goes, we can't rule that out right now. So I'm going to just throw it over to John and Josephine to kind of explain how they foresee this process, because this is a very unique project. It's not something that we've really gone after before. It's not your typical, you know, playground renovation or, you know, putting up a kit gazebo. It's really something that's very unique and comes with a lot of unique liabilities all on its own based on the fact that it's a staircase down a bluff next to Lake Michigan.
Hey, Chris, translation from, you know, Chris language to layman, what's a switchback stair ramp? I know what ADA accessible means, but I don't know what the term you use was.
You probably can explain it better than I can.
Okay.
A switchback ramp means it's like a road up a hill. If you imagine a road going up a steep incline, it goes one way and then it comes back. So rather than going down,
rather than having a 200-foot-long ramp, you end up with a ramp that comes, that has a landing and then goes down to another landing and that goes down to another landing. So you make that ADA grade, and you don't end up.
Like what the street is now to get to kind of the beach, and you go up.
Yes.
Like a hiking trail up a mountain.
Yeah. You've been to Winnetka's new configuration. They had to put a switch back in. So.
The one that did that project for Winnetka.
Pardon me, Chris?
The engineer that we're using comes highly recommended from that particular project.
Exactly. They have experience dealing with the bluff in the same situation.
Yeah, it's a complex project also because there are all sorts of different soil conditions. And if you go out and look at the staircase at the moment, so you can see as you get down towards the water, basically the foundations aren't holding.
Got it.
And you have a situation where up around the back of the building, it's very protected. It's been excavated, so you're dealing with clay soil. Then you come around the corner and it changes, and you go from clay to sand. Meantime, water is over topping, coming down the bluff, and actually pours out to the staircase. so we have to resolve that. So this project will have landscape architecture, but it'll also have architectural design, and in particular, structural design. So this is not like making a staircase in a house or in a, you know, in a standard situation. It's complex. So we'll need the work of structural engineers, and structural engineers are extremely expensive. They get paid about 2.5 to 3 times more than a civil engineer. So anytime you use a structural engineer, your cost shoots up. So that's one of the issues with the fees. And it's complex. So it's not like, for instance, in the Overlook, the design was, okay, stick in piles, you know, you've got concrete boards to go in front of it. This is, how do we fix the various soil conditions, and how can we do that in the most economic way? And CBEL will be examining a series of different structures, and will hopefully, we'll translate that to you, because there does seem to be a difficulty between civil or structural engineers explaining anything to the general population.
One of the other challenges that we ask them with is to ensure that whatever we build is freestanding, because we want to make sure that no matter what happens at that site with the water plant in the next 20 or 30 years, that we're not going to be tearing our staircase out.
Mm-hmm.
If we're going to do it once, we're going to do it right. And we're going to make sure that it's there for a long time, and hopefully something that we never have to worry about again. Because I'll tell you, there's one piece of infrastructure in the Park District right now that keeps the director of parks up at night. It's this one. I mean, because I always say after a big rainstorm, I wait for the call to come in that staircase is at the bottom of the hill. So I think there's a little bit of urgency with this one, because it's really become the only means of access to this facility.
What you're saying?
Can I just add a little context, a little information that my fellow commissioners might remember, that about a year ago we rebuilt this staircase. And within, I don't know, 4 weeks, Chris, maybe you can correct me, within 4 weeks there were significant rain events that caused the foundations to get undercut due to that overflowing water that John talked about. And, you know, so within 4 weeks of this beautiful new staircase being constructed, it was sitting there cockeyed because it didn't have appropriate foundations. I'd also add that those very attractive rubber carpet things that you saw in Chris's diagram don't fully appreciate how slippery that whole area becomes. It's so wet all the time that it basically has that very slippery moss on it, or I'm not sure if it's moss, but it's a sort of very smooth green carpet. It, once it gets damp, it's like being on a slip and slide.
Okay, Stephanie, go ahead. Dudley, you're next.
I was going to say I agree with that, because I've had that experience with those stairs, so.
Dudley?
Okay. It's not clear to me, are we looking at a staircase or a ramp or both? I'm not quite sure how that works.
We're looking initially at definitely a concept for a stairs, but also because of ADA, we're going to look at the possibility of having a ramp system. We will then compare the cost and the efficacy of where we go from there. Also, we'd like to change the arrangement of the stairs. Chris made a very important point. We don't know what's going to happen with the water plant. At the moment, the staircase is up against the water plant, is protected by the water plant, and we'd like to pull it away, if possible, from the water plant and turn it to the north. So also we don't have to worry about inundation by the lake. So it's probably a completely different look. So our ramp Our concern straight off is the ramps will be much more expensive than the staircase. So we will probably be coming back to you to make a decision.
And longer, right?
And much longer. No comparison.
As a cyclist, I've cycled on prefabricated, they're almost bridges that are similar to, I think, what you're thinking about. That may help reduce the cost a little bit, although it's a challenge probably to get them in there. But we'll see.
No, I think it's important to note that there's not really ever a good time to work in this area. So we are going to feel some pain when we have to work here. I mean, because it's either going to be in the spring or it's going to be in the fall. And as far as sailing goes, the fall is much better for sailing. So I we're going to have to see how the cards fall. But I don't see this as an area that it's going to only be worked on outside of the season. I think we're going to have to feel some pain on this one, unfortunately. So, you know, we'll come back to the board with more information on that. But that's where we're at right now as far as timeline goes.
Also, Chris, access for contractors is incredibly difficult.
Yes.
Because you have to go between the bluff and the water plant.
Yeah.
It's 8 feet wide. So that is going to be very interesting.
It's going to be a very challenging project. It's going to have the right design and the right contractor, because it's not going to be something that is off the shelf.
Chris, there's two vestigial staircases over there. There's the one that is right up behind the water plant. And then there's one that's actually more of a switchback staircase that's much more deteriorated, that's literally behind the boating beach.
Yeah.
I don't know why I'm mentioning those, other than, I don't know, is there some way that those can be, does that generate any ideas or ways that they could be used?
No, that's a good point. The stairs that you're talking about on the north end are in such poor condition that I don't think they actually started as switchback stairs. That north end, that staircase comes down from the road, that belongs to the village. So it's kind of really what you would call abandoned in place. The staircase behind the water plant, which is used to access the boating facility on the 4th of July only right now, I know that in the plan to look at that crib wall between the halfway house and the water plant, there may be an opportunity to make some improvements into that little plaza area there, like where you turn sideways to walk through that gate. But we haven't really had any dialogue with the village about either their desire to make improvements to the staircase or really what the merit that would be, if any, at this point.
Yeah, and I know they're making another ingress egress point to the beach.
Yeah.
Would be costly just from an operational perspective, putting aside the capital cost.
Yeah.
And that concrete set of stairs is also really, really steep and really tall, which is kind
of... I doubt you'd probably be able to build something like that in this day and age. I mean, it's kind of like that kind of thing that really was a great idea in 1935, before there were so many attorneys.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you got your work cut out for you, ultimately, with the water plant there, for sure.
So are the commissioners understanding that it is a more expensive design fee due to what we've discussed, and is everyone in favor of moving forward? So I will start off by saying I'm fine with it. Yes, move forward. Dudley?
Yeah.
Stephanie?
Yeah.
Josh?
Yes, thank you.
Michael?
I'll speak selfishly, since my kids go up and down that every day for a sailing camp, that you know, I think the safety of my kids, but also the safety of everybody in Glencoe is important. I don't want to fix the name or sleep. So it's a long-winded way of saying yes.
Great.
I did want to remind people that there is camp down there, and it's not just, you know, the Joshes and the Michaels of the world that go down there.
Our kids go down. And just a quick question for Josh. Josh, considering the probability that some of this work is going to be undertaken during sailing season, is it possible to get to the boating beach via the beach most of the time?
Well, the answer is it depends on how high the lake is and what direction the wind is out of and how big the waves are. If it's, you know, if it's April 1st and it's a nor'easter at 20 knots, probably not. You'd be taking your life into your hands walking around the front. But if it's, you know, if it's August 20th and the water's 65 degrees and the water's flat, yeah, as of now, you can walk around the front.
Okay. And Chris was pretty ingenious to put a gigantic, like, jersey barrier there that every kid jumped on to cross for a few months. So, I mean, I think Lisa Brooks, I think the ingenuity of Chris and his team to make that work, you know, there's a really tiny little path behind the, at the fence by the water plant and behind where the paddleboards go that you can use in an emergency, but as Josh said, sometimes taking your life in your own hands with it.
Right.
That would be something to discuss at the Lakefront Advisory, Bobby and Chris. And
absolutely. Yes. Yes. Yeah. A management issue. Okay. So,
Can I try and share something with you?
Yes. Yes.
Really, please.
It's. I'm struggling a bit here.
I'd help you if it's a picture of me with a coffee cup in your hand, John. That's all I'm telling you.
No, I won't do that to you, because. I was trying to get a video to play, but I think it's too big.
You talking about the water?
I sent it to you both, Chris and John, just now.
Maybe you can share it with the commissioners later.
Sure.
Yeah.
Could do that.
It just shows the amazing amount of water that can come down that bluff and pour out.
Okay, so
I'll share it with you later.
I believe, Josephine and John, unless you want to hang around for the policies and procedures manual changes. Okay, all right. Then thank you so much for your time. I think it was really productive to have the presentation and have you available for all our questions. And based on the comments from the other commissioners, we're really appreciative of this evening's presentation. And I believe you have what you need, and we appreciate it, and have a good evening.
Thank you very much.
Have a good evening.
Bye.
Thank you.
Did you want me to share that movie?
Let's not do it just now, because we've got this very important.
I can share with the board members later. I'll send it to them.
That sounds great. Okay. Now we will move on to the review of changes to the Financial Policies and Procedures Manual. And Carol, you will lead this discussion.
Yes. Included in your board packet is the, well, very first Financial Procedure and Policy Manual that was approved by the board back in October of 2017. In the last 3 years, we've just added a couple of manuals, more internal, for the time clock processing system, as well as the board approved a new debt disclosure policy. And we'd also updated the investment policy, very small changes to that, as well as the fees and changes. So it's taking all those changes and incorporating them into the new manual, and the staff is just asking for your approval at the board meeting to approve them. It's just standard practice to look through the policies and procedures and make changes as needed. But as identified,
we're required to review our manuals, you know, every couple of years and make changes and bring them to the board for approval. So if there's any discussion, any of the items, if not, we'll grant it in December at the December board meeting for approval.
My change is the same. Thanks.
Okay. Commissioners, are you good with advancing it, or does anyone have any questions? Dudley?
Can you just give a 30-second summary about what was changed? Like, it looks like the disclosure policy, is that it? Everything else?
No, there's, if you look at the memo, it outlines the five areas and the page numbers. So we did like a little summary on the memo page.
Right, the page 28, 38, 42.
Yep.
Can you just give a quick highlight? I mean, just a quick summary.
Sure, Carol. Yeah, we added a debt disclosure policy after we issued the new bonds, just yep. identifying me as the person to follow up with EMMA disclosures. And we did a time clock processing system that we implemented in March of 2019, so there's two appendixes added to the back of the manual. I believe the discussion from the fees and charges from the last committee meeting were yep. made in there on page 61 and 62, and the investment policy was just a cleanup, and we had modified it slightly to add governmental pools, AAA rated. I think we approved that a year ago, so it was just including that in the manual now, the updated versions.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Oops. Actually, one really weird quick question for you, Carol. I noticed that we charge a $20 fee when we're crediting someone who has, not for canceled class, but if they've changed their mind or they're dropping or something. Does that cover the cost of the transaction? I mean, outside of the labor cost, does it cover the...
Oh, yeah.
Oh, it does. Yeah. Okay, good.
Yeah.
All right, good. So there's no reason to increase it because things have changed or whatever. Okay. All right.
Not,
great.
No.
All right, so I'm fine with it.
Fine, more to be a... It's not designed to be cost recovery. It's designed, I presume, to be more, hey, you know, don't cancel the class if you really need to, or don't sign up willy-nilly for a whole bunch of classes and then have a free cancel.
Exactly.
Right.
Yeah, although $20 is, I mean, it's...
No, but look, if you're going to sign up for five classes and cancel...
Right. Well, that is true. That is true. Oh, good point on that. Yes, absolutely.
I find in society are not cost recovery, but are behavioral.
Yeah, I agree, Michael. That's why we do it.
Okay. Does anyone not approve of moving this forward? All right. Carol, I think you have your answer.
All right. Thank you.
Okay, so we will move on to other business. Lisa Shepherd will lead the discussion if there is any.
Sure. I just have one thing, an update on the Frank Lloyd White cottage. The construction has been delayed again due to COVID. Issues. One of the contractors had COVID, his wife had COVID, so they had to be off the site for 2 weeks. So depending on who I talk to, it's either end of December or after the holidays, but middle of January. Look for completion of the exterior of it, but not the sidewalks or restoration of the turf. So I just want to give you an update of that, because that is going past the official year mark. December was the year mark. So, but with COVID-19, these are to be expected. That everything was kind of pushed back. So, but other than that, it's going very well.
Is that fence still up, Lisa?
The fence is still up because they are still doing the construction out there with heavy machinery. So, I'm hoping that I will follow up on that, because that's a question I had, but I didn't get an answer by tonight's meeting. Is once that exterior restoration is done, will they take the fence down? Regardless of if the grass is restored or the sidewalks in. I'm hoping they do.
Yeah, that was my comment.
Yeah.
Was the year start, did they already move it? It's already been, no. Can't
no, they no. The year started the moment we approved the contract, which was last December. So
okay.
That's when the year started, and everything else was delayed. So.
Imagine there's a force majeure in that contract that probably, you know, a lot of people are using with COVID, but.
Yeah, there is. So, I have not had any neighbors call me, in particular, demanding, hey, it's been a year. I think they're thinking that time also based on the moving date. So,
yeah.
But I keep on reminding them of that so that they don't call. So,
do we have any evidence that the drainage is going to be much better than it was beforehand? So at least when it does rain again, we don't expect this, and if it does, we have a way to knock on someone's door.
I'm sorry, are you talking about the drainage at the Frank Lloyd Wright site?
Yeah,
it's village. It was approved by the village.
Correct, and we did get a chance to review the drawings, so in the sense that there was zero drainage at that site prior, there is significantly more drainage there now. I mean, is it going to mitigate a 100-year rain event? Probably not, but it's going to be a substantial improvement over what was there.
Chris, what I heard was we went from zero to something more than zero, and that is what I wanted to hear.
That's all I have.
anything else for Lisa? And I believe there is not. The board will now enter into closed session where no action will be taken. I entertain a motion that pursuant to Section 5 ILCS 120/2 of the Open Meetings Act, the board will enter closed session to discuss a lease as mandated by Section 2.06 5 ILCS 120/2C5. Those present during the executive session will include all commissioners, Lisa Shepherd, Carol Mensinger, Chris Leiner, and Bobby Collins.
And I would like to add Jenny Runkle also.
And Jenny Runkle. Can I get a commissioner to move that motion?
Moved.
Second.
Thank you. Any discussion? All right. Lisa Shepherd, please note the time and do a roll call vote, please.
It is 8:37.
Recording.
Okay, I entertain the motion to return to open session.
So moved.
So moved.
Second.
Okay.
Any discussion? No. Lisa, note the time and do a roll call vote, please.
It's 8:56. Commissioner Boren?
Yes.
Commissioner Covey? Commissioner Levin?
Yes.
Commissioner Onderdonk?
Yes.
Chair Brooks?
Yes, motion passes. I entertain a motion to adjourn.
So moved.
Second.
Roll call vote, please.
Commissioner Boren?
Yes.
Commissioner Covey?
Yes.
Commissioner Levin?
Yes.
Commissioner Onderdonk?
Yes.
President Brooks?
Yes, motion passes. Meeting adjourned. Thank you.
Thank you all.
Yelling in the background.